Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. President Trump's plan to impose tariffs on imported steel and aluminum has some people concerned about retaliation from other countries and the effect on the U.S. economy. Others are concerned about how the tariffs could impact the NAFTA renegotiations. Glenn Hammer is worried about both. He's president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce, and he joins me. And Glenn, from your perspective, what would the impact of the tariffs be specifically on Arizona?
Well, Arizona, we know it will be 100% negative, and this is why. There are about 140,000 total steel jobs. Arizona is not a steel or aluminum producer. There are 6.5 million jobs across the country that use steel. So basically, for every manufacturer in the state of Arizona, there's going to be a cost increase. And that's bad for business.
And presumably, those manufacturers would have to then pass the costs on to consumers, which makes the goods that we buy more expensive.
Absolutely. So, you know, this to me should be offensive to Joe Sixpack. You know, so much of beer is distributed in cans. The price of these cans are going to go up, and the price of beer is going to go up. Cars. When you think about the middle class, cars, what are cars made of? Now, yes, there's some new composite materials in cars, but steel and aluminum still play a very major role in most of our manufactured goods. All of those products are going to see price increases, and some will be very substantial.
There's been some talk about potential retaliation from other countries in terms of maybe making it harder to import in those countries, for example, Harley-Davidson's from Wisconsin or bourbon from Kentucky, things like that. Is there anything that is made in Arizona that you are concerned or your members are concerned might be more difficult or more expensive to export?
Well, when you get into these, into a trade war situation, the biggest problem is really uncertainty. You just have absolutely no idea where a country might go in terms of retaliation. So, you know, one country may go in terms of Harley-Davidson. Another could go in a completely different direction. So it puts every industry on edge. And let me just say, this is completely unnecessary. We're at an economy now that is moving along very nicely. The tax reform bill is working. Deregulating the economy is working. We're basically at full employment. This throws sand in the gears of all of this progress, and it's just economically foolish.
I'm wondering if agriculture, and I know this is not necessarily an area that, you know, you do a lot of work with, but I wonder if agriculture is one of those industries that could potentially be hard hit if there is retaliation or some kind of trade war.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm glad you brought up agriculture. Yeah, agriculture will absolutely be hard hit. Agriculture tends to be on the front lines when it comes to any sort of disruption in trade. In fact, agriculture is already feeling the pain because of the slow walking of the NAFTA negotiations. Mexico, for example, is looking at different countries to source corn. That's not good for the corn growers in Iowa. You think about cotton. Cotton's one of the, you know, is a major crop in the state of Arizona. A lot of blue jeans are made in Mexico. So trade wars, and when you start getting into the tit for tat, it could go into all sorts of different directions. And contrary to what the president says, trade wars are not easy to win. In fact, they are impossible to win, and there are only losers, and we will lose.
You mentioned NAFTA, and there's been some talk out of Washington, D.C. that, for example, if NAFTA renegotiations go well, that Canada and Mexico may be exempted from these new tariffs. I'm wondering what you think about NAFTA negotiations and basically these tariffs being used as a bargaining chip in those talks.
Well, the whole thing is absurd. The focus is supposedly on overproduction of steel in China and aluminum in China. And those are absolutely real issues. But, okay, if China is the perpetrator and the grounds are national security grounds, why are we going after Canada, Mexico, and South Korea? How many Arizonans are scared of Canadians? China is export 2%. 2% of our steel exports are from China. So this really should not have anything to do with the NAFTA negotiations, except for this. It makes it even the trade imbalance with China and some of the issues associated with China, they are real issues. This should be causing this administration to be rushing towards more robust free trade agreements with our friends, particularly Canada and Mexico.
Do you get the sense that if these tariffs go into effect, that Arizona may be harder hit than other states? I mean, how do you think Arizona would be affected relative to some of our neighbors, maybe?
If NAFTA unravels and we get into a trade war, border states like Arizona, like Texas, will be harder hit. Like Texas, 40% of our exports go to Mexico. Our single largest source of foreign direct investment is from Canada. Border states will get hit harder. And then you look at certain industries like tourism. Every day our friends from Mexico spend about $7.5 million staying in our hotels, eating in our restaurants, shopping in our stores. If there's a disruption to the economy of Mexico, we're going to feel it. And the same with Canada.
Glenn Hammer is president and CEO of the Arizona Chamber of Commerce. Glenn, good to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Last night, the city of Phoenix inched toward the possibility of considering the way its elections are held. That could mean city council races would appear on the same ballots as state and federal races. That would be a dramatic change from what's currently being done. Here are council members Jim Waring and Laura Pastor.
The biggest thing that suppresses voter turnout is the current system. If we make a change, turnout's going to go up just by virtue of the fact that we're not doing the silly stuff we're doing right this second.
We do want a higher voter turnout, but we also want those disenfranchised communities, such as independents, Latinos, a voting bloc that comes out to vote, to be able to have the access to vote.
The comments at the city council meeting came just hours after the Republican-controlled state house voted to set up a system that could force cities to move their local elections to even-numbered years. Joining us for a few minutes with more details is Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, good morning.
Good morning.
So what does the legislature boil it down for us? What are they trying to do here?
Well, basically, they're saying that they believe that consolidated elections, in other words, forcing cities to have their elections the same time as federal, state legislative offices, will increase turnout. And there is some anecdotal evidence to say that that's true. But the other side of the coin, of course, is the question of if you have city council races that are way at the bottom of the ballot, you know, after you vote for the governor, after you vote for lawmakers, after you vote for judges, you know, will anybody really pay attention at that point? What the legislature said is, you know, if in fact your city elections have substantially lower turnout than comparable statewide elections, we're going to force you to consolidate. And that's a maneuver done to try to get around a prior state Supreme Court ruling that said that city elections are none of the state's business. This is the way of saying, oh, yes, it is. Turnout is a matter of state concern.
Mm-hmm. So we don't overstate this because, as I said, Phoenix sort of inched toward considering this. But considering, again, that Phoenix and Tucson in particular have been fighting the state over this kind of thing for years, you mentioned the Supreme Court ruling, why would this have legs when in the past there hadn't been? And not that you can read city council members' minds. Obviously, you cover the state legislature. But is this a sign to you in some way that they think the state may have more heft behind this particular legislation?
Well, this comes down to trying to guess what the Arizona Supreme Court would do. Again, it's very clear the Supreme Court has said local elections are strictly a matter of local concern, and therefore charter cities like Phoenix, like Tucson, like Chandler can decide when they want it to have their people vote. Now, if the belief is if you tweak it, you know, it's sort of like, well, the Supreme Court has actually decided against the cities, against the state twice on this. It's sort of like, oh, this time we've really got the magic formula. And this time we can force them to do it. Now, Phoenix may be figuring, let's not pick a fight with the state, whether they do it or not. We might as well, you know, go ahead. Now, that doesn't mean there won't be a legal fight, because I spoke to Mike Rankin, who's a Tucson city attorney, and he said, look, this measure is no more constitutional than the last one, and therefore we're going to fight it if, in fact, it becomes law.
Howie, you know, I'd never ask you a cynical question, but do we think state lawmakers really want to increase voter turnout? Are they really that concerned?
Well, it depends on which voters we're coming down to. I think that's part of what Laura Pastor was talking about. I mean, there are other things you can do to increase voter turnout. One of the arguments is if you allow for same-day registration. In other words, if you have an Arizona driver's license, to get an Arizona driver's license, you have to prove you're legally present in this country. So the question is, should you be able to use your Arizona driver's license and register and vote the same day? Republicans have constantly beat that back. They say it's designed to go ahead and create the, you know, voter fraud and such. So, again, it depends on which voters you want to come out and which ones you think will make a difference.
And, Howie, finally, obviously we haven't seen how far this can go, but since you've been down there as long as you have, the fact we have a Republican-controlled House and Senate, a Republican governor, do you expect this to go through again this time and see if we'll have legal challenges yet again?
Oh, I'm almost positive that this will become law. Now, will it remain law? You know, you can lose a lot of money on betting what the Arizona Supreme Court will do, particularly since they gave Doug Ducey two more appointments to increase it to seven. So I'm not betting lunch over that or even, you know, a little after dinner drink.
Okay. Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, always good to talk with you. Thanks.
It's the show. Thanks for listening this morning with Mark Brody and Lauren Gilger and the Takeaways' Todd Zwillick. I'm Steve Goldstein.
March 8th, today, is International Women's Day. The United Nations has used this day for decades to celebrate women's economic and political achievements, but also to bring focus to essential issues affecting women everywhere, and especially in poorer countries. Now, over the last year, women across the globe have protested sexual harassment and violence with the Me Too movement here in the United States, Yo Tambien in Mexico, Spain, and South America, Balance Tampoc in France, and Anna Kamen in Arab states. Well, this year, UN Women is hoping to transform this momentous amount of female activism into broader action. Fumzila Mlambo Nguka is executive director of UN Women. Her team is using International Women's Day to focus on rural women who make up over a quarter of the world's population, but are lacking resources and support in almost every measure of development.
Rural women and girls are one constituency that is at risk of being left behind, not unless we take active and targeted approaches to reach out to them. We are talking about rural women, but forging alliances between rural women and urban women, especially because in urban areas, in most countries, you have pockets of women who have some of the same challenges that are faced by rural women. So we don't want to overlook those women as well.
You've connected the Me Too movement and the Time's Up movement in the United States and other Western countries to the plight of rural women and farm workers. Can you explain what these two phenomena have in common, in your view?
Yes. What the Me Too movement captures is the high prevalence of harassment and sexual abuse in women by perpetrators who never have to be accountable, and impunity that goes unchecked. In all cultures, women are just never believed or taken serious when they complain about any form of harassment. In fact, they do not even have words for it. As a result of this movement, all over the world, institutions, governments are having to actually look at the environment that they provide for women. It is generating a conversation that is relevant for women everywhere. The truth is, if the Me Too movement is able to help to foster a change of culture, which is relevant for us in the United Nations, because that is where everybody sits, from the United States to Bangladesh, to the Congo, to South Africa, to Argentina, all of these countries are here. And our responsibility as UN Women is to help member states to set standards on these issues. For the next week, which we do every year, we sit and we discuss issues that in the Commission of the Status of Women, issues that are critical for women. This year is rural women, but we will bring this issue. We are going to be able to show how what is happening in Hollywood happens also even in a more intense and more devastating way in the rural areas.
Well, these two issues have collided in Myanmar, the treatment of rural women and sexual assault and harassment for that matter. We have followed the ethnic cleansing and the harassment of the Rohingya people as they fled Myanmar into Bangladesh. And you've just returned from the Cox's Bazar refugee camp in Bangladesh, where so many Rohingya refugees have taken refuge now. What did you see while you were there?
Well, it is very clear that the women in that refugee camp are traumatized. The numbers are huge. I have never seen a refugee camp of that size. The number of children that you see there, and the fact that these women who themselves have nothing are sitting there, many of them without their partners, carrying their own children. There's very little food and facilities that you would need as a mother bringing up children. It is truly one of the most devastating experiences that any society and any community could ever go through.
And we should also make very clear the systematic use of rape on the part of Myanmar soldiers and paramilitaries to terrorize Rohingya women on their way out of the country as part of this horrific ethnic cleansing.
Yeah, and no possibility for the women to seek justice. While I was there, we launched a program in partnership with the Bangladesh National Human Rights Commission to do the best that we can to interview, to document from women whatever experience they were willing to talk about their abuse and rape. Those who are able to name their perpetrators, to provide us that information so that we can start documenting and producing a book of some sorts, that one day, somewhere, there may be an opportunity for justice to be served. We will do what we can to capture some form of data and information that can be credible enough to be used in a court of law.
There is an agreement now between Bangladesh and Myanmar for refugees to begin to return to Myanmar, although a lot of observers have said this agreement is premature, there's no accountability, there's no monitoring. They've tried to put the brakes on this plan. You've been to Cox's Bazar. Do you think that refugees should be returning now from Bangladesh back to Myanmar?
Well, on one hand, when you look at Cox's Bazar and the fact that this is not the best place for anyone to live for a long time, you would wish that they go somewhere else where it is safer. But when you think about where they have come from and the fact that when they go back, people like you and me will not even have access and would not be able to go and support them, would not be able to deliver medical care, you realize that they're between, you know, a hard place and a rock. But the difference about being in Bangladesh is that there's a semblance of support, protection, law, even though not all their rights can be protected, but there is recourse of sorts and they work with people who want to support them. Once they go back, I think all of us have really limited capacity to be of support to them.
And have there been any assurances or guarantees from the government in Myanmar that if and when Rohingya refugees do return, that they won't be simply persecuted again?
Well, I am really not aware of that, but all of us are aware of continued and systematic violation of rights. So I think common sense should tell us that the time is not yet right.
Well, on this International Women's Day, your focus is on rural women now. What's the biggest focus for the UN Women's Organization in 2018 beyond this year's notoriety?
Well, the issue and the theme of violence against women is still very strong because of the size of the problem as it exists globally. We're focusing on trafficking in Asia. We're focusing on cultural practices that are harmful to women in Africa, such as child marriage, female genital mutilation. We are focusing on domestic violence and sexual violence in Latin America and equal pay. In different countries, depending on what is possible for us to do in a particular country, we'll focus on more than one aspect of women's economic empowerment. But in all countries where there's still legislation that discriminates against women, we are spending a lot of our time and energy in either helping to repeal those laws, to amend those laws, or to pass laws where there's a gap. For instance, in countries that have no laws that criminalize domestic violence. In some countries, we have laws that allow for a man to be forgiven for rape if he rapes a minor and then marries the minor. That is considered as having atoned, which means that the poor child is married to her rapist, who then can rape her for the rest of her life.
I wanted to ask about some of the debates that have been going on in some Middle Eastern countries. We've been covering it, the so-called marry your rapist laws and changes in the law in places like Lebanon, I believe, Tunisia, other countries. Also places like Saudi Arabia, where the kingdom appears to be trying to liberalize at least its image and giving more rights to women to drive, for instance, which is a very small step in this day and age. How encouraged are you by the legal changes that have been made in these countries since it seems to be your focus?
Well, we have been part of making these changes. So we are encouraged because a lot of our energy, time and budget goes into changing these laws and then into supporting the implementation and helping to fight the stereotypes and the laws that will exist even when you have got the good law. But the slate has not been cleaned completely. We still have about 37 countries where women are still expected to marry their rapists. So our focus as UN Women is to eliminate all of these laws and to make sure that where we don't have the laws that are enabling and protecting women, then those laws are passed.
Phumzile Mlambo Ngmuka is Executive Director of UN Women. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That's Todd Zwillick at our partner, The Takeaway.
If you haven't yet heard of the Four Tool Brothers, you probably will soon. They are artists and brothers who have been building a body of work that is becoming increasingly recognizable in and out of the art world. And it's becoming increasingly recognizable here in Phoenix, as the brothers, Gabriel and Isaac, have intentionally worked to support and grow the art community here. While they have a following around the world, the Four Tool Brothers designed the art for the inaugural Lost Lake Music Festival that took place here last year. They're working with local museums here and local businesses. Right now, they're painting a giant mural on the wall of Garfield Elementary School in downtown Phoenix, where they live. I sat down with them recently to talk more about their work, their love of the desert, and after years of working in the art world, how they became the Four Tool Brothers.
So my brother and I have been working together professionally in the art world for over 16 years. But 5 years ago, we decided we wanted to work together as the Four Tool Brothers. And part of that process or that decision was coming up with the style of work that we have right now and developing a style that has less lines but is more impactful. So less is more.
I think the art grew as people do, as we grew from young adolescents into men and now into growing into more mature adults. You know, our voice and our ideas became more clear and more simple and more succinct, and the art naturally took that same path.
So what are you trying to communicate with this style that you've adopted?
We're really wanting to present what is important and significant in life for everyone. You know, I feel that we can break many barriers and take down many walls that man has created by just remembering that we all need to eat, we all need clean water, we all need clean air, we have to maintain this beautiful earth that we live on, we have to take care of it, and it will in turn take care of us. And that's what we try and do, represent universal messages and imagery that can be recognized from Arizona to Tokyo to Colombia or to anywhere in this earth. I think that's very important for us, is to really represent everyone and everything.
Yeah, yeah. I'm interested in the transition to Arizona and how you said it sort of was random the way you ended up here. But I'm interested in how that connection grew. And then does that come out, you think, in your work?
Well, I think that growing up on the East Coast close to New York, we were exposed to a very modern place, very fast-paced city and civilization. And it took just going somewhere. It wasn't specifically Arizona. We just needed to change our vibration and explore and see more of the world, to look within ourselves and find ourselves. And Phoenix happened to be that place. And once we were here, something called us here. And there's an energy here that opened up our minds, our third eye. And it, once we got here, it just, something clicked and it just took off. And I think our vibrations came together and our energies went to a new place.
it's also been an opportunity to be a part of a very young city, a city that is going through transition, and it has really given us the chance to mold the direction of the arts community, of the cultural community, of the grassroots humanitarian sort of communities, and just be a part of it. So that's something that's very unique. You don't always have that chance, to get involved at kind of the ground floor of something that is blooming, that is peaking.
It sounds like you guys want to not only help shape that, but be a voice for what Phoenix becomes.
Absolutely. I think part of being an artist is you have a responsibility to have a voice and have a positive voice that will influence not only people now, but in the future. So we definitely take that seriously and always think about all of those things.
This isn't surprising since you're an artist, but it sounds like the way that you approach this is almost spiritual.
Absolutely. I think not only in the arts, but in everything that people and humans do should be done with a purpose and with spiritual conscience. And that is something, the way that we were raised with our family, and something that we as artists and people continue to search for and to grow as men and as people.
So you've been really visible in the community here lately. You're participating in local events. You were the artist at the Lost Lake Festival. You worked with the Phoenix Art Museum. You're working with some local businesses. So it sounds like this is all very intentional then, what you're doing here.
Everything really for us has always been connected. One thing has always led to another. Whether it's an opportunity to represent Phoenix at the inaugural music festival, Lost Lake, or raising money for a local charity via that festival, or, working with local business owners that started, in the same place that we did, which would be just downtown Phoenix. I mean, it's all connected. It's all related. Whether working with the Phoenix Art Museum or with the Heard Museum, which we're going to be doing a lecture at in June, we definitely believe that as much as you receive, you have to give back even more.
So as artists, the goal is always obviously to create, like you said, but I also think there's another side to it. There's business side to it, right? We all have to eat. We all have to survive and make money. Do you feel that tension?
We would always create art or work as artists, whether we were making the money or not. And I can say that because we've done that. Mm-hmm. We've worked many jobs to be able to continue doing what we love, what our passion is, and we will continue to do that. What has happened over time after putting in years and years of work is that people have gravitated to what we do. And the fact that now we have that monetary support, it just allows us to do much more. Now we're getting, kind of the best thing that an artist can get is like somebody who's willing to actually support your vision by purchasing a piece or commissioning a mural. That's what you dream about, because now you can actually make major change.
It's exciting times. This is, we've worked so hard throughout the years, and now this is what we've dreamed of. So it's like we're ready, and I feel like this is what we were meant to do. So,
Gabriel and Isaac, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you.
Gabriel and Isaac Fortool are the Fortool brothers. You can see some of their art on our website. Check it out at theshow.kjzz.org.
It's almost time for the next episode of The Quiz Show. That's when we bring back our resident quizmaster and Jeopardy! Tournament of Champions winner, Leszek Pawlowicz. He'll face off against a KJZZ staff member in a game of trivia, but you can get in on the action too. Just solve this riddle. What can you catch but not throw? When you have the answer, email us at theshow@kjzz.org. We'll randomly draw two names from the correct answers, and either Leszek or one of our KJZZ newsroom staffers will play on your behalf. If your player wins, you'll win a special KJZZ item.
So, Steve, you know when you go to visit a relative, they start pulling out the old photo albums?
Oh, I can't wait to see those sepia-toned photos of young Mark.
Oh, man, those are fantastic. Well, so if Park Central Mall were a person, it would be going through basically that same thing right now. When the current owners of the property peered into the mall's basement, they found a bunch of photo albums and other items all about this mall.
From baby Park Central to teenage Park Central. It was like a ready-made museum collection spanning decades of the mall's existence. The developers passed it on to ASU historians, who are combing through it now. The show's Annika Klein has this preview.
When we flip through these different scrapbooks, it's really like a time capsule.
ASU history professor Matt Dalmont is looking through just a few of 20 scrapbooks that have barely been touched in decades. The pages are filled with clippings about Park Central Mall, a new store opening, a family-friendly event.
Usually people don't think about the history of a mall being something you would hold on to. And so I think we were lucky that it was kind of stashed away and forgotten in the basement. So now we have a chance to go through it and try to understand this moment in Phoenix's history.
It's a moment that began in 1957, when Park Central Mall was boldly opened north of downtown Phoenix on farmland. Phoenicians today know it as Midtown.
And people were actually worried when they considered the mall that would people go that far north to go shopping?
They did. Goldwater's and Diamond's department stores migrated from downtown Phoenix to become the mall's anchors. And in between the stores was a space where it seemed like anything could happen. Dalmont points to an image from the 60s.
There's a U.S. Air Force fighter jet parked directly outside of Park Central Mall. This is the height of the Cold War, where the U.S. is competing against Soviet Russia. But they have both a Titan missile and an Air Force jet outside of the mall.
Because why not marvel at the military's prowess before you buy a new handbag? There were all kinds of sensational events like this to draw people to the outdoor mall. The newspaper ads hype up a giant balloon parade, jetpack demos, hula hoop competitions, baby chicks riding a tiny Ferris wheel, a diver jumping into flaming water, and an annual pigeon race.
I can only imagine that they had a series of racing pigeons flying around the parking lot. The prize was a his and hers set of matched Volkswagens, which is a pretty good prize.
The historians quickly realized how many Phoenicians had passed through this mall at one point or another. They decided to go beyond the scrapbooks and see what else they could learn from the people who lived this history.
Really, there was no place else that had all this in it, in one spot, you know.
Irma Jepson was a shopper at Park Central from the time it opened. More than 50 years later, we're sitting together in the mall's lower level. Jepson just finished recording her memories for the oral history part of the ASU project.
My mother and my sister and I used to come here and shop a lot. It was an all-day thing. We came when we shopped, and we had dinner there, or lunch there. And sometimes they had fashion shows.
Jepson remembers how her husband would tease her for ordering the liver and onions at a restaurant called the Geronimo Room. And when she was a teacher, she brought her students here on field trips.
And I had my kids line up and talk to Santa Claus. He was usually sitting on a throne right in the middle of Park Central.
She says some of those kids had probably never been to a mall before, and they took in every detail with wide eyes. These small anecdotes are treasured by Matt Dalmont and the other historians.
It's really a story of everyday history. I think that's what's so valuable about it, is that it's very hard to get a sense of how do people dress, what did they drink, what did they wear, where did they shop, where did Phoenicians spend their time?
By the mid-1960s, the answer to that last question became more varied. Park Central Mall had competitors, and they had air conditioning. Still, the mall kept up appearances.
We kept the floors clean. We kept the ashtrays clean, strained them with a wire strainer.
It was one of Mike Larson's first jobs in high school, the step up from paperboy. Larson worked here in the early 70s with some of his classmates.
A lot of good memories. We did the sign changing, and you know, sometimes we'd misspell something. Even though it was given to us on paper, we'd get the call saying, hey, you know, you got that letter wrong. So, okay, we'd go fix it.
The marquee signs have changed countless times since that gig, and the mall stopped being much of a mall in the 90s. But just being back here within these walls has Larson reeling memories in like fish on a line.
When we'd all have to come shop with Mom, Dad would go into Smuggler's Inn, and that's where he would spend his time while we shopped.
Today, a few businesses and a temporary branch of the city library are open during construction. Most of the time, the parking lot is just a parking lot. But the current owner has big plans to turn the location into something that speaks to this decade. A tech workspace with community gathering areas and art galleries. It's expected to be completed late this year. Irma Jepson is glad to see the building and its past are being preserved.
I think you just need to know history a little bit. It wasn't one of my favorite subjects in school because I didn't care about all that old stuff either when I was young. But now I learned to appreciate this old stuff.
She points at herself when she says this and smiles. The historians plan to show the stories to the public this spring. It'll be another event for the Park Central History Books. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
And there will be another oral history collection at Park Central in April. Photos of Park Central memorabilia will be up on our website, theshow.kjzz.org. Starting tonight, three agencies will host a planning session called a charrette to think about the future of the state fairgrounds. And that includes considering the future of the historic buildings on the fairgrounds, including the 1938 WPA building. It had been slated for demolition a few years ago, but was ultimately saved. With me to talk about this weekend's events is Jim McPherson, board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. And Jim, what is the state of these historic buildings right now?
So there has been an update on all of the vintage and historic buildings at the Arizona State Fairgrounds, both conducted by an ASU graduate level class and the City of Phoenix Historic Preservation Office. They've done building assessment reviews. There has been work on reviewing what those the improvements need to be, and the charrette will help to decide, prioritize what buildings can and should be preserved.
What are you hoping will come out of this weekend's event?
The charrette is like a follow-up of an event that happened in the spring of this year, or excuse me, of last year, where the governor's office opened up a request for information to get a general idea of what people were thinking about the fair and the fairgrounds in Midtown Phoenix. And it was wide open, and they got maybe 6 to 8 responses, plus much response from the general public as for ideas of what the fair could do, what it could be, how it could be improved, those sorts of things. So this is a much more deeper dive into planning for the fairgrounds and its future.
I know that in the past, money has been a pretty significant hurdle in terms of trying to renovate the buildings and, you know, get them back to where you would like them to be. Is that still a pretty significant hurdle, coming up with the money to actually do the work?
When we became involved, the main issue was the 1938 WP administration building. And we were successful in working with the public sector, private sector, nonprofits to raise significant funds to begin the renovation of that building. And those funds are out there ready to be used to begin renovation. There are numerous other buildings on the campus of the fairgrounds, and these are resources of the state of Arizona. So part of what this charrette will do is help give an idea of what the priorities are of what are the needs of each of the buildings on the campus, and what funding alternatives there could be to restore them and bring them back into use.
I know that one of the discussions has been, should the fairgrounds continue to be where they are, at basically 19th Avenue and McDowell in that neighborhood. If the fairgrounds were to move, what does that mean for the preservation of the historic buildings on the current fairgrounds?
Well, it's been gratifying to hear over the past I think it's been 1,350 days since the issue was brought up about the 1938 WPA building, has been a greater realization and understanding and appreciation of the assets that the state does have, the historic assets, and what these buildings have represented over time and what they could be used in the future. We've seen in cities and towns across Arizona the adaptive reuse of historic resources. And I think because fair officials and state government officials in general have seen these buildings now as assets rather than liabilities. And it's been great to see the exposition and state fair board, the state historic preservation office, and the governor's office pull together this planning charrette, which will help us get a better idea of what those buildings can be used in the future, whether it be the fair, or whether it be something else.
So you think even if they do not serve the purpose for the fair, that they could have another life for another purpose in that location?
Absolutely. During this time, we've talked with numerous private developers who have expressed interest in developing in and around that area of town, which is, granted, still rather industrial in nature, but it is an opportunity for investment. And, you know, the fairgrounds is 88 acres in size. It's one of the smallest state fairs in size in the nation. So, you know, there could be opportunities for development if the fair needs to move, and then use of those buildings for future benefit to the community.
All right. Jim McPherson is board president of the Arizona Preservation Foundation. Jim, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Mark.
As part of efforts to increase border security, the Trump administration has proposed hiring 5,000 additional Border Patrol agents. But there have been concerns that some agents destroying water left in the desert by humanitarian aid groups has caused issues, and that migrants are seen as threats to American security rather than as people looking for economic opportunity. Former Border Patrol agent Francisco Cantu writes about those issues and others in his new book, The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border, and he's with me. Francisco, why did you join the Border Patrol, and what were your expectations for the job?
I joined the Border Patrol right after college, and in college I had studied immigration and border issues. And I think, you know, my idea of the Border Patrol was probably similar to what a lot of people's understanding of it might be. I wasn't really a law enforcement-minded type person. But coming out of college, you know, I was looking at it as sort of an extension of my education. I grew up in Arizona. My mother was a park ranger. You know, so I grew up close to the desert. And I felt like a lot of the learning that I had done in college about immigration and border issues, it felt very severed from the landscape. And I guess I sort of became hyper-obsessed with the line itself, like the actual terrain where the border divided the two nations. And I wanted to understand that place, and I wanted to be out in that place, you know, day in and day out. And when I thought about the different ways I could do that, even though I didn't see myself as a Border Patrol agent, I thought that, you know, that would give me the best opportunity to do that. And I thought it would also expose me to answers to all these questions that I had, all these policy questions.
How much more dangerous has the border become in the time of the coyotes and the smugglers and however we want to describe them, as opposed to what had been more of a guest worker program? I think we'd describe it that way. Does it feel like a much more dangerous place, and the people who are out there are more desperate?
I do think that our policy has served to make the border a much more dangerous place. And, you know, quite often, you know, we will point the finger as a nation or as an agency at the drug cartels and say that that's why this place has become violent. I really think that that's intimately linked with our own immigration policy and our sort of failure to update it or to reform it. You know, we've had in place ever since the 90s, there's been this policy of enforcement through deterrence. And in this policy, you know, you sort of enforce the urban, easy to cross parts of the border and push those crossings out into the more dangerous, rugged terrain. And so what that does is it really serves to weaponize the landscape.
Now, you describe in the book that you went through some, I'm going to call it stress, although it's much stronger than that, and you had nightmares and that sort of thing. Did you feel guilt in some aspects of this job?
You know, in the Border Patrol, there's not really a culture of talking about the ways that you might be affected by that work, or the ways that that work might be causing you to sort of set aside compassion or a broader sense of humanity. And I think that, you know, that's similar with a lot of military and law enforcement jobs. I pushed a lot of that aside. I pushed a lot of those doubts about what I was doing away. And I think that probably most agents do that. You know, you do that in order to just get up every day and show up at work and continue doing the same thing that you're doing. Those doubts, I think, began to manifest themselves more and more loudly in my subconscious, in these, you know, these dreams and these nightmares. those were alarm bells, I think. You know, your subconscious is quite often attempting to grab hold of you and shake you out of a waking stupor. And the only other thing in my life that sort of served to do that was, I guess, my mother, you know, who was sort of constantly interrogating me and calling me back to a sense of who I was before I joined that job or who I was outside of that job.
So what do you make of where we're at now? We have a situation where the Trump administration has, in some ways at least, drastically changed policies, even though President Obama was labeled by some deporter-in-chief, so in some ways he was not exactly seen in favorable ways. Where do you think we're at in terms of the understanding of what goes on at the border and what our policies should be?
I think that in a lot of ways, perhaps for many people that live along the border, the day-to-day realities of the place are perhaps not that different now than they have been. I think that there's more attention focused on the border. There's more eyes. There's more people paying attention. But the gravity of what occurs here, the violence that occurs here, the dehumanization of migrants who are risking their lives to cross the border is something that has been sort of ongoing across every administration. I do think that the level of rhetoric, the degree to which our rhetoric has been debased, is alarming. You know, migrants have long been, I think, dehumanized in the media, dehumanized by our political discourse. You know, we use these words like a flood of migrants or an uptick in migration as if migrants are sort of this line that can be plotted on a graph. The idea of like a cat and mouse game, you know, all of this language encourages us to think about migrants as part of this indistinguishable mass of people, one indifferent from the next.
And considering how people feel about immigration and the border and whatnot, what kind of reaction have you gotten? And have you been surprised, pleased, whatever it may be by it?
You never know what sort of political landscape your book is going to be released into. I was working on this book long before Trump announced his candidacy. And the entire time I was working on this book, I imagined that it would be sort of seen as a relic of a much uglier time. And of course, that's really not the case. And I think, you know, my position as a former Border Patrol agent, I'm writing from a place of great privilege and as a person who has wielded a lot of power over people. And so I think what a lot of people see when they look at this book is the narrative of a former cop. And they say, you know, that's not the narrative that we need to be hearing right now. And to be honest, in a lot of ways, I agree with that. I think that the people who we most need to be giving a platform to, the people whose voices we most need to be hearing right now are the voices of migrants, because these are the people who are most directly affected by our immigration and border policy. We have to listen to them.
Francisco Cantu is a former U.S. Border Patrol agent and author of the book, The Line Becomes a River, Dispatches from the Border. Francisco, a pleasure to talk with you. Thank you.
The pleasure's all mine. Thanks for having me.
If you've ever bought a house, you know how complicated the process can be. There seems like there's a ton of paperwork you have to sign on the dotted line over and over again. And some new companies are noticing. Sites like Open Door and OfferPad are coming into the residential real estate market with the goal of making this whole process easier. But are buyers and selling losing something in return? Mark Stapp is the executive director of ASU's Masters of Real Estate Development program. He came into our studios recently to talk with me more about these online real estate platforms and their effect on the industry. So we started with the big question. If you're using one of these sites to buy or sell your house, are you losing out?
So it depends on whether you're buying or selling, right? And in both cases, you have to consider what we would call opportunity cost. So if I'm using this to sell, and the site like OfferPad as an example wants to purchase my house. So they're going to give me a guaranteed purchase price. They're going to buy my house and they're going to give me the time I need to stay in the house to find someplace new, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. I have to wonder whether I'm leaving money on the table. So in a market that's very active, for instance, one of my neighbors in Arcadia put their house on the market. It was on the market for 3 days and they had four offers, three of them above listing. That's the consideration you have to make when you're saying, I'll just take your offer.
Without putting it out on the
market. Without putting it out on the marketplace. Now, for some people where the market isn't that active or they're in a really big hurry, they're not concerned about those opportunity costs. They've done their homework and they go, eh, that's okay. I'll do it. It's simple. I'm done. Probably works really well for them.
Right. I wonder, okay, so you could be leaving equity on the table, but you might not always be. If you were the buyer, how is it affecting you?
I don't think it has as much effect on the buyer side. I think the buyer has other issues that they need to be concerned with that have to do with their ability to evaluate the opportunities. Mm-hmm. And one of the roles that realtors typically play is they guide, they coach, they answer questions, et cetera. So depending on what platform you may be using, you may be missing some of that guidance in answering the questions and pointing out issues about a property that you may not be as familiar with. I think overall, what these are causing is the residential real estate market to have to become more of a consultative role than simply a transactional role. Because what they do is they provide information, they provide efficiency by making the necessary services easily available to you, and they're doing it in a way that they try to remove confusion. Now, on the flip side of that is not every piece of real estate is the same. They're all very different. Even if it's the same house in the same subdivision built by the same builder at the same time, there may be big differences. And the ability to understand the overall marketplace, to point out those differences, to know what the alternatives are, becomes helpful to a potential buyer. So I think that's one of the trade-offs that buyers may have.
Yeah. So it's essentially replacing one middleman, a traditional realtor who will take you around to to houses and show you and guide you through the process, with another middleman, which is an online one, right?
No, it's exactly right. There's still a person in between a buyer and a seller, and it may be a virtual person sometimes, or it may be a group of people that are working behind the scenes. But if you're not as experienced in the market or in this business, your ability to understand what you're seeing may be diminished.
So let's talk about how this affects realtors then. So we don't know exactly how big of a market share they're taking up at this point, but it is growing and it seems to be getting some traction, like you said. If it continues to grow, could this affect or sort of take the place of your local realtor?
I don't know that I'd go so far as to say it completely takes the place of them. It may shrink the number of people with licenses that are making a living doing it. I think that's a distinct possibility. But I do think one of the other things it may do is create these efficiencies in the paperwork, in the communication process. I think a lot of the brokerage, the major brokerage houses, are all looking at how they use technology to support their agents and transitioning some of their platforms to be able to use technology to make business more profitable and to deliver information to agents so that they can be more informed and help their buyers. So I don't think that the traditional real estate companies are simply going to sit back and let this happen. They're also looking at ways that they use technology and information. We saw this happen with Zillow. We saw it happen with Redfin. We saw it happen with the companies that came into the marketplace and started making information about available homes widely available. And I do think that, and I've said this to various real estate agencies and groups, that they have to be concerned about the fact that their entire business was based upon control of information.
Right.
And that's no longer the case. And so the ability to control the information, to control the transaction has gone away. And now what you've got is you've got people in the marketplace that are gathering information and helping them make decisions. And that puts pressure on the real estate agents to have to interface with them. Mm-hmm. So it's like going to the doctor and he's talking to you about a surgery he thinks you need, and you're starting to ask him all sorts of critical questions about the surgery, about your disease, about the recovery, about the process. And you're like, wait a minute, I'm the doctor. So I think that real estate agents who will be successful in the future are going to understand how they use these platforms and this technology to leverage their ability to be the expert.
Okay. Mark Stapp, thanks so much for coming in.
You're most welcome.
Mark Stapp is the executive director of the Masters of Real Estate Development Program at ASU.
You're listening to the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
My name is Lynn Baskfield.
My name is Bill Gorman, and we've been out here on a moonlight walk. You know, off the beaten track.
There was so much moonlight and silver on the cactus leaves.
You can see this one has a lot of like curvy arms.
Yeah, they're cool.
Biologists.
Walking through riverbeds and along old trails.
And actually the ranger and those up ahead really set a pace. We're going, oh, this is not a stroll. This is a hike.
It's been great fun.
I was listening to the people behind us talking, and I heard one man say, you know, you don't have to be rich to be rich. And that's how it feels out here.
That's Lynn Baskfield and Bill Gorman on a full moon hike in Cave Creek. If you have suggestions or hear things that make Phoenix Phoenix, send us a note, theshow@kjzz.org.
Pianist Emily Baer has done a lot so far in her career. She's played Carnegie Hall and the White House, put out albums, and gotten into composing. And she's only 16 years old. Baer has done jazz and classical. For goodness sake, she was on Ellen when she was 6. She recently stopped by our studios for a chat, and I started by asking her a question she's probably been asked about a billion times already, how she started playing piano.
I actually don't remember like a specific time where I was like, you know what, I'm going to start playing piano today. I'm going to start writing music. It was just kind of always in my life. I can't really remember a time where I wasn't, you know, doing music and there wasn't music around me. And it was convenient that we had pianos in the house already, so it was pretty organic. I just kind of went for it.
At what point did you think that this might be a way that you could make a living or something that you wanted to do sort of full time?
I knew pretty early on that I wanted to do this the rest of my life. I don't remember like an exact time, but since it's always been such a huge part of my life and I really can't imagine it without it, that it's always been what I've wanted to do and where I've wanted to end up.
How old were you when you actually started playing?
I was pretty young. I was around 2, and I started just messing around on a piano and making things up. And then when I was 4, almost 5, I started actually piano lessons, classical piano lessons. And a few months after that, I started jazz because, you know, I love the freedom of jazz and, you know, writing music was always such a big part of me. Jazz sort of gave me that freedom that classical didn't always have. And then I kind of grew up doing both, like bilingual. And when I was around 8 or 9, I got into the world of film scoring and that whole world of, you know, orchestration and Logic Pro and all that whole stuff. And then about a year and a half ago, I actually started songwriting. So now I'm just kind of all over the place and doing a bunch of different things. But I'm really excited because I'm working on some new projects that are way completely different than what I've done before. So
it's interesting because I think for a lot of parents and a lot of kids, they measure growing up in terms of like when you first spoke or when you first started walking. It sounds like your family clearly has those things, but you also have like when you wrote your first piece or when you did your first composition or first, you know, started playing piano.
Yeah, pretty much. It's always been around. And again, it's like the same thing as, you know, taking your first steps or doing the first blah, blah, blah. But it's just, I don't know.
For you, it happens with black and white keys instead of just like walking on the ground or something.
Yeah.
What does it feel like for you when you are sitting at the piano now?
When I play, I don't know. It really honestly depends on what I'm playing. You know, sometimes it can be like, you know, a release or something that I find really comforting. And other times it's, you know, more intense where I'm working on something that I really need to get to. But when I'm performing, I don't know, it's just, it's a lot of fun because it's something that I feel like so at home doing that it just feels really natural and I love doing it.
And you've played at some pretty spectacular places. I mean, you've played Carnegie Hall, you've played Lincoln Center, you've played the White House. You don't get nervous doing that?
I don't usually get nervous, you know, maybe here and there for a special or different kind of performance, I get a little nervous. But no, nerves aren't really like a thing.
Where do you get your inspiration to compose your music?
It can really come from anywhere. You know, inspiration can come from a person or a place I visited or an experience I've had, honestly, anywhere.
In doing some reading about you, one of the words that keeps coming up is prodigy. People describe you that. It seems constantly. I'm wondering what you think about being labeled as that.
You know, I've never really loved being labeled a prodigy because I feel like a lot of times it has a kind of a negative stereotype. But, I mean, I was really young when I started doing music, so I can get why I'm labeled like that. But, I mean, I'm not only do I have music, I have a pretty balanced life, and so I have friends and a dog and I go to summer camp every year and all this stuff. So it's been pretty good.
What was it like growing up with you playing music, your siblings doing music, your mom doing music? I mean, I have this picture in my head maybe of like the Von Trapps or something, like all singing together and, you know, having a great time. Was it kind of like that at your house?
I mean, we had a really musical family. So my sister plays harp and my brother, she also plays piano, but her main instrument right now is harp. And then my brother played piano and sax and guitar a little bit. So we always had, you know, music around, whether it was Lauren on the harp or me on the piano. But we were all really supportive of each other. And we all had our own things. Like my sister is a competitive figure skater and my brother was the head of the rowing team. So like it was pretty balanced. But yeah, very musical family. There was always someone on an instrument somewhere.
You could have had a battle of the bands in your own house.
Yeah, sometimes when we both have to practice at the same time, things get ugly.
I'm wondering how you try to keep things new and fresh for yourself. You referenced that you've been doing a little more songwriting, but you've done so much in such a short amount of time. How do you try to prevent yourself from getting burned out or bored or anything like that?
Like I said, just keep on trying new things. And there's so much for me to learn in the stuff that I've been doing already. And there's so much for me to learn, you know, in all these different worlds and songwriting and film scoring and blah, blah, blah. It never gets old.
Is there anything you've not yet had a chance to do, place you haven't had a chance to play, somebody with whom you'd like to collaborate, like something you'd really love to do that you're hoping to do at some point?
Oh, there's countless. I couldn't even begin to list all of them.
For kids who are getting into music, who are learning how to play the piano or learning how to play the guitar, how do you try to sort of instill in them an appreciation of the kinds of music they're playing and a love of the kind of music they're playing and try to encourage them to sort of find their own musical voice?
Well, I feel like a lot of the times when kids are learning music, they're put in a box into what kind of music they need to learn and have to play and blah, blah, blah. And while I appreciate that and I think it's great because I think you need to learn certain things and you need to play certain things in order to get to a place where you can play stuff that you want to play, but I think that you should really, in addition to playing those things, you should do what you want and you should make it fun and you should make it interesting, because if you don't, then what's the point of doing it if you're not going to want to do it? And of course, I know all that feeling when you sit with a piece for the first time or you sit with an instrument for the first time, you're like, how am I ever going to do this thing? Like, how am I ever going to play the piano? Or how am I ever going to play this song? I know that feeling, but you just got to work through it slowly and, again, make it fun and interesting.
Well, and it seems like that's really important because I would think for somebody who's played the piano for as long as you have, I think it would be easy for, at some point, for it to feel like a chore and not to be as fun as it seems to be for you.
I mean, I'm sure there's points where I'm in the middle of learning a piece and I'm like, oh my God, this is taking forever, you know, everything. But most of all, I mean, like I said before, it's something that I really love doing in the end, and it's something that I really can't live without or see myself living without, so it's all worth it. Yeah.
Emily Bear, thanks a lot for coming in. It was really nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, too.
Sixteen-year-old pianist Emily Bear's latest album is called Into the Blue. And by the way, she mentioned she's gotten into scoring films. The music you're hearing now is her work from the 2017 film Aurora.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.